There was Samael, the first to loose demons upon the earth. Azazel, the forger of weapons, who fell from grace when he gifted humans with the instruments of violence. Belial, who did not walk among men, was described as the prince of necromancers and warlocks, and a thief of realms. Mammon, the prince of greed and wealth, could be bribed with money and riches. Astaroth, who tempted men to bear false witness, and who took advantage of the grieving. Asmodeus, the demon of lust, and rumoured general of hell's army. Belphegor, the prince of sloth, and, strangely, tricksters and snake oil salesmen. Leviathan, the demon of envy, chaos, and the sea, who was monstrous and rarely summoned. And lastly, of course, there was Lucifer, the leader of the archangels, the most beautiful of any prince, the leader of the rebellion against heaven. It seemed impossible to James any of them could be his grandfather. It was like having a mountain for a grandfather, or an exploding star. Nothing evil was more powerful than the princes of hell, save perhaps Lilith, the mother of demons. He sighed and set the book down, trying to push back an intrusive thought of Grace. He did not like the way they had parted at the riverbank. She had said she would need time, and he knew he must give her that. Still, the thought of her burned inside his stomach, as if he had swallowed a match tip. A knock on the door pulled him from his reverie. He set his book down, rising to his feet. His muscles ached. "Come in," he called. It was his father, but Will was not alone. Uncle Jem was with him, a noiseless presence in his drifting parchment robes. His hood was down, as it often was when he was inside the Institute. Will had told James many years ago that when Jem had first become a silent brother, he had not liked people to see his scars. It was strange to think of Uncle Jem having such feelings. "Someone's here to see you," Will said, moving aside to let Jem pass into the room. He glanced from his son to his old parapetai. James knew that under the songs and jokes, the careful deflection, his father was a man who felt things deeply. He himself was like his father in that way. They both loved intensely and could be intensely hurt. If it bothered Will that James and Jem had secrets he did not know and could not share, he did not show it. James had been miserable until Jem had shown him how to control the shadow power. All Will had ever cared about was that after his lessons with Jem, James seemed happier. Will's blue eyes were deeply shadowed. James knew he and Tessa had been up for hours, first in the sick room and then in the library. James and Lucy had stayed with Thomas as long as they could, until he had returned to Christopher's house, silent with grief and exhaustion. Afterward, Lucy had gone off to the library to look after Alexander, but James had returned to his room. He had always been the sort who bore his pains privately. Will ruffled James's hair and said something about being needed elsewhere before slipping out of the room. When he was gone, James sat back down at his desk and glanced up at his Uncle Jem. "You sent for me?" Jem said. "Yes, I need to tell you something, or perhaps ask you something. I am not sure which." "Is this about Barbara, or the others?" asked Jem. "We do not know why she died, James. We think the poison reached her heart. Piers and Ariadne remain in a stable condition, but the brothers' need to find a cure has become even more desperate." James thought of the blood Christopher had taken from the infirmary, the laboratory in the house on Grosvenor Square. He knew Christopher was doing all he could to find a cure for the demon poison, but he couldn't help but hope Henry would come back from Idris soon to lend aid. Not to mention there was the matter of the dirt James had found in the Shadow Realm. "I sent the message to you before I knew about Barbara," James said, dragging his thoughts back to the present. "I feel foolish now. My problems do not measure up to those. Tell me why you sent for me, said Jem. I will be the judge of whether or not it was important. James hesitated.
I cannot tell you all of it, he said, for reasons I cannot explain entirely. Only know that I encountered a demon who told me that my grandfather was a prince of hell. He glanced up at his uncle's face.
Did you know that?
The white streak in Jem's hair danced as he shook his head.
As I've been searching for your grandfather's name, I've heard a great many stories from different sources. There was one, a warlock woman, who told me he was a prince of hell. But there were also others who named different demons. Since I do not know who to trust, I thought it better not to burden your family until I was sure of the truth.
Perhaps a clue could be found in the Shadow Realm, said James. I'm seeing it more and more, just as there seem to be more demons in London. If there's some connection.
Did the demons at the lake speak to you? Mention your grandfather?
James shook his head.
I assume the demon who identified your grandfather was the Cerberus demon in the greenhouse in Chiswick, said Jem. James didn't contradict him. It was close enough. It could be that this demon, having been bound to Benedict and Tatiana, had heard your name and said to you whatever it felt could hurt you most. Demons are deceptive. It might not be the truth.
But what does it mean if it is true? James whispered back. If I am descended from a prince of hell?
It means nothing about who you are, said Jem.
Look at your mother, your sister.
Would you claim some flaw in them? You are your mother and father's son, James. That is what matters, what has always mattered.
You are being kind, said James,
kinder than the Clave would be if it turns out to be true.
Jem took James's face in his hands. His touch was cool, as always, and his face was young and old at the same time. How could he look no older than James, and at the same time, ageless?
If you saw humanity as I can see it, Uncle Jem said, there is very little brightness and warmth in the world for me. There are only four flames in the whole world that burn fiercely enough for me to feel something like the person I was. Your mother, your father, Lucy, and you. You love and tremble and burn. Do not let those who cannot see the truth tell you who you are. You are the flame that cannot be put out. You are the star that cannot be lost. You are who you have always been, and that is enough, and more than enough. Anyone who looks at you and sees darkness is blind. He let go of James abruptly, as if he had said too much. It is not enough, is it? Jem said. His silent tone somehow resigned. The uncertainty has been planted. You feel you must know.
Yes, James said. I am sorry.
Very well, said Jem. I will call on an old friend on one condition. You do not mention this again to anyone until we hear from him.
James hesitated. He was keeping so many secrets already. Secrets for Grace, the secret of the attack in Chelsea, the secret of Emmanuel Gast. Before he could reply, though, the sound of clattering wheels echoed from outside. There was a crash, and James heard the front doors of the Institute fly open. He raced to the window. Jem was beside him instantly, noiseless as a ghost. Several carriages had drawn up in the courtyard. In the cool light of the moon, James could make out the coats of arms of the Baybrooks and Greenmantles, but not the others. He heard shouting. Will and Gabriel were racing down the front steps. The door of the Greenmantle carriage flew open, and two women clambered out, supporting the body of a man between them. His white shirt front was soaked in blood, and his head hung at an angle, like a broken doll's. Beside James, his uncle had gone rigid. There was a faraway look on his face. James knew he could speak inside his mind to the other silent brothers, gathering information from them.
"It's happened," Jem said. "There's been another attack."
The light of late morning was yellow as butter. It hurt Cordelia's eyes as she paced the Swords and Stars tiles of the vestibule at Cornwall Gardens. Sonar and Alistair were both fast asleep. Risa was in the kitchen, humming to herself as she made naan à Barbarie, a flatbread that was her specialty. Cordelia had not been able to sleep at all. Between her desperate worry over her father, the news about Barbara, and her new concern for Alistair, she had not been able to lie down, much less close her eyes.
"Poor Thomas," she thought,
and poor Barbara, who had been so happy dancing with Oliver, walking with him in Regent's Park. Shadow hunters knew death. They accepted that death came, in battle, by knife or tooth or sword. But for a strange poison to steal away life while one slept, like a ghost or a thief, was not part of shadow hunter life. It felt wrong, like a boot put on backward, just as it felt to imagine losing her father to the injustice of the Clave. The sound of a knock on the front door nearly sent Cordelia sailing into the air. The Lightwoods housemaid had the morning off. Cordelia glanced toward the kitchen, but Risa must not have heard the knock. There was nobody to open the door but her. Cordelia braced herself and flung it open wide. James Herondale stood on the front step. She caught her breath. She had never seen him in gear before, and its darkness made his hair look more black, his eyes the burning gold of a lion's eyes. Around his upper left arm was a white silk band of mourning. He met her gaze without flinching. His black hair continually looked tousled, as if he were caught in a storm no one else could see. "Daisy," he said, "I have very bad news." She could pretend she didn't know, but suddenly she couldn't bear it.
"Barbara," she whispered, "I know. I am so sorry, James. Charles came by last night. He's friends with Alistair and..."
"I feel I ought to have known they were friends. They were both in Paris at the same time, weren't they?"
James ran a hand through his tangled hair.
"But why would Charles have come by so late to see your brother? He couldn't have known about the attack yet."
"Attack?" Cordelia stiffened. "What attack?" "There was a small gathering at the Baybrooks last night. When the visitors left, they were savaged by a group of the same demons that attacked us in the park."
Cordelia's mind raced. "Was anyone killed?"
"Randolph Townsend," said James. "I didn't know him well, but I saw them bring his body in. Vespasia Greenmantle and Gerald Highsmith were wounded and poisoned." James ran his hands through the already wild crown of his black hair.
"Is the Clave admitting now that this is not a problem limited to Regent's Park?"
"Yes," said James bitterly. "And they are going to set more patrols, in a wider area, though my parents are begging them to call in warlocks and the spiral labyrinth.
The attack was at night at least, so they are less panicked, but I am not sure they should be. This was a group of adult shadow hunters. They were armed. Everyone has been since the picnic. But according to the Baybrooks, they were cut down in an instant. Only Randolph had a chance to raise a seraph blade before the demons were sinking teeth into their flesh."
"Did the demons vanish suddenly, the same way they did at the lake?"
"Apparently the Baybrooks said they were gone nearly as quickly as they appeared."
"It seems to me," said Cordelia, "that they are not simply seeking to kill. They seek to bite, to sicken."
James frowned. "But Randolph was killed."
"He was the only one fighting back," said Cordelia. "It seems to me they are willing to kill. Barbara or Piers could easily have died of blood loss, but their directive is to spread this infection."
"So you think someone is controlling them?" said James. "Good.
So do I. Hopefully we can find out who from Ghast. Ghast? Echoed Cordelia. His eyes sparked a dark gold. One good thing happened last night. It seems your trip to the Hell Ruel was successful. Hypatia Vex sent Ragnar Fell to assist us with the name of a warlock who may have summoned these demons. Emmanuel Ghast. He glanced up toward the windows of her house. Ragnar did insist that we keep the information a secret.
Another secret, said Cordelia. There do seem to be so many now. And poor Thomas, does he know?
About Ghast? Yes. Ragnar came just before we found out about Barbara. Pain flashed across James's face. Thomas blames himself for her death, though there is nothing he could have done. James looked exhausted, Cordelia realized. He had come far out of his way to tell her this news, so that she did not have to hear it from people who didn't know Thomas, or care about him, or his friends.
He must be desperate to leave, she thought.
She couldn't keep him here talking when he no doubt wished to be with his family, or with Grace.
It was kind of you to come and tell me, she said, leaning against the doorway. I would ask you in for tea, but I know you must be eager to return to your family.
Actually, I am not returning to the Institute. I have made a plan with Matthew and Lucy to confront Ghast in his flat. I'll be meeting them there. I came to see if you would join us. Surprised, Cordelia said,
Oh, did Lucy ask you to fetch me along?
James hesitated. Yes, she did.
Anything for my future Parabatai, of course, Cordelia said.
And she did mean it. She wanted badly to see Lucy, and even more to have something useful to do. Some way to help. All night she had been thinking of Barbara, who she had known so little, but who had been so young and seemed so kind. I doubt this warlock will be happy to see us, said James. Bring your gear and Cortana. We must be ready to fight. Emmanuel Ghast lived in a flat above a handkerchief manufacturer's, near the junction between Cheapside and Friday Street. Matthew pointed up Friday Street as they went past. There used to be a pub up that street called the Mermaid Tavern, where Shakespeare used to drink. In Lucy's opinion as a writer, this was not an artistically inspiring avenue. On each side of the street were dingy brown buildings with narrow leaded windows and grubby Dutch gables. Awnings hanging outside several buildings were dyed a mottled brown, too. Not by design, but with the dust of the streets and the smog of the city. Cheapside was one of the busiest thoroughfares in London, crowds surging from the fishmongers' stalls all the way to the white bell tower of St. Mary-le-Bow. She wrinkled her nose.
I don't think much of Shakespeare's taste.
Matthew smiled, though he looked as tired as Lucy felt. He wore dark gear, just as she did, a white mourning band around his wrist and a white flower in his buttonhole. He had been making jokes all morning, and Lucy had been trying as best she could to keep up. It was hard not to let her mind wander to thoughts of Barbara, of the now even more crowded infirmary at the Institute, of when the next attack might come, and who might be hurt or killed in it. Luce? Matthew touched her arm lightly. They were glamoured, and the crowds moved around them, parting like a river forking around a central island. Newsboys hawking the Evening Standard darted up and down the streets. Matthew had greeted one earlier, explaining to Lucy that he was an irregular, one of the many downworlder street urchins who ran errands out of the Devil Tavern. There is something rather odd I wanted to talk to you about. Charles, well, Charles is always odd, but Charles and Grace.
James! Cordelia!
Lucy rose up on her toes, waving through the crowds. Her brother and Cordelia had alighted from their carriage some distance away and were walking toward them. They were clearly deep in conversation, their heads bent together as if they were exchanging secrets. Lucy sank back down on her heels, a little puzzled. She rarely saw James lost in conversation with anyone other than his three closest friends. "Interesting," said Matthew, his green eyes narrowed. He raised a hand and waved, and this time James saw them. He and Cordelia darted through the crowds to catch them at the corner. Lucy stared a little. Cordelia looked so very different out of the awful clothes her mother made her wear. She was in gear, a long tunic over boots and trousers, her red hair caught back in a braid, and a leather satchel over one shoulder. She looked even younger and prettier than she had at the Institute ball. "It's a boarding house," said Matthew, as soon as Cordelia and James were within earshot. "We've already been inside. The landlady said our friend Emmanuel Garst was away from home for an indefinite period."
"Matthew was unable to charm her," said Lucy. "The woman is a block of concrete in human form. We did manage to find out the flat's the one on the third floor, though."
A smile crept over James's face. One of the things he enjoyed most about patrolling was clambering around rooftops.
"Then we go up the side of the building."
"I was afraid of this,"
Matthew muttered as they followed James into a narrow, rubbish-choked alley.
"My boots are new."
"Stiffen your sinews, Matthew," said James, "and cry God for Harry, England, and St. George."
"Shakespeare," said Cordelia. "Henry V."
"Well spotted," said James, and produced a grappling hook. He threaded the end of a rope through and stood back to throw it. His aim, as always, was excellent. The grappling hook sank into the lintel of a third-floor window. The rope unfurled down the side of the building.
"Once more unto the breach," he announced, and began to climb.
James was followed up the rope by Cordelia, then Lucy, and Matthew last, still cursing the dirt on his boots. Lucy was halfway to the window when she heard a yell. Glancing down, she saw that Matthew was on his hands and knees in the alley. He must have fallen from the rope.
"Are you all right?"
she asked in a loud whisper. When he stood up, his hands were shaking. He deliberately avoided Lucy's gaze as he caught at the rope.
"I told you," he said. "New boots."
Lucy began to climb the rope again. James had reached the window. Balanced on the lintel, he glanced around and kicked the window in. The whole thing collapsed inward, sash, glass, and all. He vanished inside, followed by Cordelia. Lucy and Matthew climbed in after them. The flat was dim and filled with a stench as of rotting waste. There was brown wallpaper smeared with grease. Pictures torn from magazines were stuck to the walls. There was very little light, though Lucy could see a humped old sofa and a stained Turkish rug. A tall bookshelf was lined with shabby-looking tomes. James eyed them curiously.
"I think Ragnar was right," he said. "There's a real concentration on the study of dimensional magic here."
"No stealing the books and bringing them back to the Devil Tavern," said Matthew. "It would not be the first time your book kleptomania had gotten us in trouble."
James held his hands up innocently and went to search beneath some of the furniture. Cordelia followed his lead and peeked behind the cheap wooden frame of a small oil painting showing Queen Elizabeth, all scarlet hair and white powder, making a most unpleasant face.
"Look at these."
There was dust in James's hair and he was frowning.
"I wonder if there's some kind of weapon."
He indicated what looked like a heap of broken pieces of wood scattered over the floor behind the sofa.
"They're awfully dusty," said Cordelia, "as if no one's touched them in ages."
James bent to pick one up, frowning, just as Matthew glanced over. He'd been searching a small, shabby desk covered with loose papers. He held up a messy sketch.
"James, look here."
James squinted.
"It's a box, surrounded by scrawls."
"It's not a box," Matthew told him helpfully. "It's a drawing of a box."
"Thank you, Matthew,"
James said dryly. He tilted his head to the side. There's something familiar about it. Does it remind you of boxes you have been acquainted with before? Said Matthew. Look at the scrawls a bit more closely. Don't they remind you of runes? James took the paper from his parabatai. Yes, he said, sounding a bit surprised. Very much so. Not runes that we use, but still awfully close. Cordelia, who had knelt down to look at the shards of wood, said, These do have runes carved into them. Our kind of runes. But they also look as if they've been part-eaten by a sort of acid. And look at those scratches on the wood, said James, joining her. He glanced at Garst's sketch, and then back at the shards. It's as if... Lucy half heard Matthew say something in response, but she was already taking advantage of their distraction to slip through a half-open door into the flat, small bedroom. Her hand flew to her mouth. She gagged and bit down hard on her own thumb, the pain cutting through the nausea like a knife. The room was nearly bare save for an iron-posted bed, a single window, and what remained of Emmanuel Garst lying ruined on the bare floorboards. Flesh and bone had been carved apart, ribs cracked open to show a collapsed red cavern. Blood had sunk in black grooves into the wooden floor. The most human-looking part of him left were his hands, his arms outflung with the hands turned palm up, as if he were begging for mercy he had not received. He had been dead a long time. The stench was putrid. Lucy took a step back. The door behind her swung suddenly shut, slamming closed with a force that vibrated the wall. She dropped her hand, tasting blood in her mouth as the thing on the floor heaved, and a black shadow spilled upward between jagged white ribs. It was a ghost. This ghost was no Jessamine, or Jessie Blackthorne, who looked solid and human. There was an awful shimmer in the air around it, as if with his violent end a space had been torn in the world. He was ragged at the edges, his face skull pale in a nest of straggling brown hair. She could see the patterned wallpaper through his transparent body. The ghost of Emmanuel Garst blinked watery blue eyes at her.
Why have you summoned me, fool?
It demanded, in a voice like the hiss of steam escaping from a pipe.
I did not summon you, said Lucy. I had no idea you were even dead, until this very disgusting moment, she glared.
Why have you dragged me back to this place of agony?
Garst hissed.
What do you want, Shadow Hunter?
Lucy reached for the knob of the door behind her and rattled it, but it was stuck. She could faintly hear the voices of the others in the parlour calling her name. She took a deep breath, almost choking on the fetid air. Even though he was dead, Garst was still their only tenuous connection to the demons that had killed Barbara. She drew herself up to her full height.
Did you summon the demons? The ones that have been attacking Nephilim in broad daylight?
The ghost was silent. Lucy could see where its throat had been slit, its spine showing through the slashed hole in its neck. Whoever had murdered Emmanuel Garst had wanted to make very sure he was dead.
Answer me, Lucy cried.
To Lucy's amazement, the warlock's flickering outlines resolved into a more solid shape. The ghost's eyes smouldered with a red anger, but it spoke, its voice hollow.
I am the one who raised it. I, Emmanuel Garst, the most scorned of warlocks. Years ago, the Spiral Labyrinth turned against me. They cast me out of warlock society. My golden reward was taken from me. I have been forced to take the lowliest of hires to feed and clothe myself. Yet all this time, I studied. I learned. I was wiser than they thought.
Wise? Lucy wondered. From the look of things, Garst's recent decisions had been anything but wise.
I see the way you look at me.
Blood dripped from the ghost's wounds, a silent patter of black stains on the bare floor.
You scorn me for raising such a demon, a death dealer, the poisoner of life. But the gold, I needed it, and the demon will kill only shadow hunters.
Someone paid you to do this, Lucy whispered. Who? Who did it?
The ghost hissed.
What are you? You are a shadow hunter, but not a shadow hunter. You drag me back from the brink.
It reached out a hand, insubstantial, curling into a claw.
What is this monstrous power?
Monstrous? Lucy snapped. What's monstrous is that you summoned these creatures into this world, knowing the damage they would do.
You know nothing of me, said Garst. I went to the bridge to raise the demon. I brought it into the world and then I captured it, kept it where it would be safe. A gift for the one who gave me gold. But when I returned here, I was betrayed. I could not stop it. My blood and my life ran out over the floor as my killer tore the demon from its hiding place.
Lucy could stand no more.
Who did this? Who hired you?
For an instant, Lucy believed Garst would simply vanish away into the shadows in the London smoke. He began to tremble, like a butterfly transfixed with a pin but not yet dead.
I will not tell.
You will,
Lucy shouted, her hand outthrust, and she felt something go through her, like electricity through a wire, like the feeling of a rune burning on her skin. The ghost threw back its head and roared, revealing Garst's warlock mark, multiple rows of teeth like a shark. Someone hit the door behind Lucy. She stepped aside just in time for James to burst into the room in a cloud of plaster dust. He had smashed the door off its hinges. Cordelia spilled in next, her satchel over her shoulder, and Matthew came after her. The latter two stood blinking in horror at the corpse on the floor. Lucy glanced at James. He nodded. He could see the ghost as well, in the way all Herondales could. It was a perfectly ordinary ghost sighting, Lucy told herself. This ghost was not Jesse.
The one who hired me came to me masked, face wrapped around in cloth, and wearing layers of cloaks.
Emmanuel Garst answered her slowly, almost reluctantly.
I know not if they were man or woman, old or young.
What more do you know? James demanded, and the ghost writhed. Who is controlling the demons now?
Someone more powerful than you, puny Nephilim, snarled the ghost. Someone who tore down my wards, ripped my body apart.
His voice rose to a wail.
I shall not think on it. I shall not relive my death. Truly you are monsters, despite your angel blood.
Lucy could not bear it a moment longer.
Go, she shouted. Leave us.
The ghost winked out of existence, between one breath and the next. Cordelia was already over by the bed, dragging the dirty coverlet off, throwing it over what remained of Garst. The air reeked. Lucy was choking. James reached for her.
I have to get outside, she whispered, turning away from her brother. I must breathe.
She pushed past her friends and into the living room. The door to the flat was not locked. Lucy clutched at the banister as she stumbled down the narrow steps and outside into the street. Cockney voices floated around her, men in round hats passing by with packages under their arms. She struggled to catch her breath. Ghosts had never frightened her. They were the restless dead, grieving and disquieted, rarely seen. But there had been something different about Garst. A coat settled on Lucy's shoulders, bottle green superfine, and warm, smelling of expensive cologne. Lucy glanced up to see Matthew's face hovering above hers, sunlight making his hair brilliant. He looked serious for once as he carefully buttoned the coat closed around her. His hands, usually swift and bright with rings, flying through the air when he talked, were moving with great deliberation over such a small task. She heard him draw in a slow breath. "Luce," he said, "what happened in there? Are you all right?" She shivered.
"I'm all right," she said. "I've rarely seen a ghost in such a condition."
"Lucy!" James and Cordelia joined them on the street. Cordelia caught at Lucy's hand and squeezed it. James ruffled his sister's hair. "Garst did not die easily," he said. "Good work, Lucy. I know that can't have been pleasant."
"He called me a monster."
But she didn't say it out loud.
"Did you find anything in the flat after I went into the bedroom?" she asked.
James nodded. "We took a few things, sketches, and Cordelia has the wood shards in her satchel." "That reminds me," said Matthew, relieving Cordelia of her bag. He approached the grubby-faced newsboy he'd pointed out to Lucy earlier and engaged in a spirited discussion with him, eventually proffering the satchel.
"Is Matthew selling my satchel to a newsboy?" Cordelia said curiously.
James smiled crookedly. "I see we'd better explain the irregulars to you, lest you think we spend our time leading London's children into depravity and crime." Matthew returned, the wind tousling his dark gold hair. "I told Neddy to take the bag to Christopher," he said. "It may be that identifying what those shards are will help." He glanced at Cordelia, who looked slightly puzzled. "I doubt Christopher has left Tom's side since last night. Perhaps this will provide a distraction for them both."
"Perhaps," Lucy said. "If we can return to the Institute, I would like to write down what Garst said, that I might remember each detail."
It was only half of what she really thought. She had lied to the others about Jessamine being part of a ghost gossip network. Jessamine never left the Institute and avoided the company of other ghosts. But Lucy knew not all spirits were like that. Many wandered. She wanted suddenly to know if another ghost might know of the death of Emmanuel Garst. She wanted to talk to Jessie. 12. The end of it. She loves me all that she can, and her ways to my ways resign. But she was not made for any man, and she never will be all mine. Edna St. Vincent Millay, Witchwife. As the carriage rolled under the Institute's gates, James saw his parents standing in the courtyard. His father was in a cutaway morning coat and a blue sapphire tie pin that Tessa had given him for their 20th anniversary. Tessa herself wore a formal day dress. They were clearly prepared to go out.
"And where have you been?" Will demanded, as James clambered out of the carriage.
The others leaped down behind him, the girls being in gear, needing no help to dismount.
"You stole our carriage."
James wished he could tell his father the truth, but that would be breaking their sworn promise to Ragnar.
"It's only the second best carriage," James protested.
"Remember when Papa stole Uncle Gabriel's carriage? It's a proud family tradition," said Lucy, as the group of them approached the Institute's steps.
"I did not raise you to be horse thieves and scallywags," said Will. "And I recall very clearly that I told you..."
"Thank you for letting them borrow the carriage to come and get me," said Cordelia.
Her eyes were wide, and she looked entirely innocent. James felt an amused stab of surprise. She was an interestingly skillful liar. At least his parents wouldn't wonder why they were all in gear. As James and Lucy had left the house earlier, Will had said to them that for years he'd trusted them to patrol in the darkness, but now they must arm themselves at all times treating day as if it were night. He'd also advised James to bring Matthew with him, which James had been planning to do anyway. I had very much wanted to come to the Institute and see what I could do to help. Will softened immediately. Of course, you are always welcome here, Cordelia, though we are, as you can see, going out. Charles has invoked the Consul's authority and called a meeting in Grosvenor Square to discuss last night's attack. Only for high-level enclave members, apparently. Matthew grimaced. By the angel, that sounds awful. I hope it's all right for me to stay here tonight. Tessa smiled. We already made up one of the spare rooms for you. As I have known Charles since he was born, I have a difficult time taking him seriously as an authority figure, said Will thoughtfully. I suppose if he says anything I don't like, I can request that he be spanked. Oh yes, please, said Matthew. It would do him a world of good.
Will,
began Tessa in exasperation, just as Bridget emerged from the front doors. She appeared to be carrying an enormous medieval spear. Its haft was worn, its long iron point spotted with rust. She clambered into the driver's seat of the carriage and sat grimly, clearly awaiting Tessa and Will. I do hope you're going to glamour that carriage, said James. People will think the Romans have returned to reconquer the British Isles. Tessa and Will climbed into the carriage. As Bridget gathered up the reins, Tessa leaned out the window. Uncle Jem is in the infirmary with several other silent brothers looking after the ill, she called. Please try not to cause them any trouble, and see to it that they have whatever they need. James nodded as the carriage rolled out of the courtyard. He knew there would be guards around the Institute as well. He had seen a few of them, marked out clearly in their black gear, outside the gates as they approached. His parents had been through too much to ever leave the Institute unguarded. He glanced at his sister, wondering if she was thinking the same. She stood looking up at the higher levels of the Institute, perhaps at the sick room. He was used to a Lucy in motion, not a Lucy who'd stood pale and withdrawn, clearly lost in thought. Come along then, Luce, he said. Let's get inside. She frowned at him.
No need to use your worried voice. I'm perfectly all right, James.
He threw an arm around her shoulder. It's not every day you see a warlock scattered liberally around his own bedroom, he said. You might as well take a little time to recover. Raziel knows none of us have had much time to recover from anything lately. In fact, James thought, as the four of them approached the Institute, he had barely had a moment all day to think of Grace. His mother always said the cure for worry was to throw yourself into activity, and he had certainly done that, but he could not leave things this way with Grace forever. He had not realized how bad the situation with Tatiana actually was. Surely Grace would reach out, and together they would remove her to a place of safety. Surely it would happen soon.
So, Jessamine, said Lucy, can ghosts lie?
They were all in Lucy's room. Matthew and James had settled Lucy on the settee and wrapped her in blankets, despite her complaints that she was fine and needed no assistance. James had insisted that he hadn't liked how pale she'd looked when she'd come out of Garst's flat. Cordelia was next to Lucy on the sofa, while James and Matthew occupied the two armchairs as only young men did, legs and arms sprawled everywhere, gear jackets tossed casually on the bed, muddy boots mussing up the carpet. Both were gazing up at Jessamine, though only James could see her.
Certainly not, Jessamine looked shifty. Ghosts are completely honest. I keep telling you, it was mice who knocked your silver mirror behind the desk and broke it.
It appears clear that if ghosts are liars, they are terrible liars, said James. Matthew sighed. It is very strange to see you conversing with the invisible.
Humph,
said Jessamine. She wobbled a bit and firmed up, her outlines clearing as she drifted down toward the floor. Shadow hunters, having the sight, could generally see ghosts who wanted to be seen, but Lucy knew it was an effort for Jessamine to make herself visible to all eyes.
Oh, said Cordelia. It's very nice to meet you, Jessamine. Lucy speaks of you often.
Jessamine beamed.
You are a very attractive ghost, said Matthew, tapping his ringed fingers against his chest.
I do hope Lucy and James have mentioned as much.
They have not, Jessamine noted.
Very remiss, said Matthew, his eyes sparkling.
You are not at all like Henry, said Jessamine, eyeing Matthew speculatively. He was forever setting things on fire, and not a compliment to be heard. Jessamine, Lucy said, this is important. Do tell us, can ghosts lie?
Not you, of course, my dear.
Ghosts can lie, Jessamine conceded. But there are certain forms of necromancy that can compel them to tell the truth, and even to allow the living to control them.
She shuddered.
That is why necromancy is so dreadful and forbidden.
That's why. Cordelia sounded doubtful. Turning to Lucy, she said, Are you worried Garst's ghost might have been lying? Lucy hesitated. Part of her hoped he had been lying, since he had claimed the demon was only meant to kill shadow hunters. It was a frightening thought.
I just don't want us to go off on a wild goose chase. Garst was insistent that someone extraordinarily powerful hired him to summon these demons. We need to find out who that was.
We also need to know what kind of demons these are, said Cordelia.
We cannot go to the Enclave just to report that Garst raised a bunch of poisonous demons.
We already know these demons bear poison. We do not know why their poison is so deadly, or what Garst did so they can appear in daylight.
This all seems very dull, said Jessamine. If you don't need me, I'll be going.
She vanished with a sigh of relief, no doubt at no longer having to keep herself in visible form. Lucy reached up to pull down one of her writing notebooks from the edge of the desk. Perhaps it was time to begin recording their thoughts.
There is another odd thing. We know Garst raised multiple demons, but he kept referring to one demon. He said he raised it, not them.
Perhaps the demon had offspring, James suggested. Some demons have dozens of spawn, like spiders. From outside Lucy's window came the rattle of wheels and the neighing of horses. A moment later, there was the sound of cries from the courtyard. James and Lucy both rushed to the window. A driverless carriage had drawn up before the Institute's front steps. Lucy recognized the arms on the side instantly, the four C's of the consul. It was Charles Fairchild's carriage. The carriage door flew open, and Grace tumbled out, her hair streaming over her shoulders, her dress stained with blood. She was screaming. Beside Lucy, James's body tensed like iron. The front doors of the Institute burst open, and Brother Enoch came rushing down the steps. He reached into the carriage behind Grace and lifted out the twitching body of a woman, clad in a stained fuchsia dress. Her arm was bloody, wrapped in a makeshift bandage. Tatiana Blackthorne. Cordelia and Matthew had joined them at the window. Cordelia had her hand over her mouth.
By the angel, said Matthew. Another attack.
Lucy turned to tell James to hurry to Grace, but there was no need to say it. He was already gone. James burst into the infirmary to find a scene of horror. Screens had been put up between the beds along the west wall where the sick lay in their poisoned sleep. James could only see their silhouettes, dark shapes hunched under covers, still as corpses. At the far end of the room, two beds had been pushed together. Tatiana had been carried across the room, and blood smeared the floor in a trail leading to where she lay sprawled crosswise upon them, her body jerking and twisting. Her shoulder had been torn, and her arm. Her hat had come off, and the thin tufts of her greying hair were matted to her skull. Brother Enoch was bending over Tatiana, dripping dark blue fluid from a beaker into her open mouth as she gasped for air. James thought wildly of a baby bird being fed by its mother. Jem stood by, holding bandages soaked in antiseptic. Grace knelt in the shadows by the foot of her mother's bed, her hands gripping each other tightly. James approached, passing the beds in which the other patients lay in their restless, drugged states. Ariadne, Vespasia, and Gerald might only have been sleeping, had it not been for the dark maps of black veins beneath their skin. They seemed to grow more visible by the day. "Hello, James." It was Jem's voice, gentle in his mind. James wished he had something to tell his uncle, other than the frustrating threads of a mystery that refused to knit itself together. But Jem was already searching out the identity of James's grandfather. He couldn't burden Jem with more questions that might have no answers. "Will she live?" he asked silently, indicating Tatiana. Jem's voice was unusually strained. "If she dies, it will not be because of these injuries you see here. The poison. Death dealer, poisoner of life," Garst had said. But what in the angel's name had he raised? "James." A hand caught at his arm. He looked down to see Grace, her face ashen, her lips deadly white. She was gripping his arm with both hands. "Take me out of here." He turned slightly to shield them both from view. "Where shall I take you? What do you need?" Her hands trembled, shaking his arm. "I need to talk to you, James. Take me somewhere we can be alone."
"James has been gone for an absolute age," Lucy said. She had been scribbling in her notebook, but had begun to look worried. "Would you go and look for him, Cordelia?"
Cordelia did not want to go look for James. She'd seen the look on his face when Grace tumbled out of Charles's carriage in the courtyard. The longing that had turned so quickly to fear for Grace, the quick, unconscious way he'd touched the bracelet on his wrist. He hated Tatiana, she knew, and with good reason. But he would have done anything to protect her, to spare Grace pain. She wondered what it would be like to be loved like that. Even alongside her sadness, there was a strange admiration in her for the way that James loved Grace, the all-encompassingness of it. That didn't mean she wanted to barge in on James and his lady love. But Lucy had asked, and Cordelia could see no reason to refuse. She smiled weakly.
"I'm not sure I meant to leave you alone with a man," she said. "Seems scandalous."
Lucy chuckled.
"Matthew's not a man. We used to hit each other with soup ladles as children."
Cordelia rather expected Matthew to laugh too, but instead he looked away, suddenly occupied with a spot of dirt on his sleeve. With a silent sigh, Cordelia ruffled Lucy's hair and went out into the corridor. She was still learning her way around the Institute. The symbols for Shadowhunter families were everywhere, and as Cordelia passed them, witchlight touched the shapes of wings and the curves of towers. Cordelia found a set of stone steps and headed down it, only to jump in surprise as Anna Lightwood stepped out from beneath a marble frieze of an angel poised over a green hill. The Dragon of Wales was pictured in the background. Anna was in trousers and a jacket of sharp French tailoring. Her blue eyes were the exact colour of Will's, darker than Lucy's. They matched her waistcoat and the lapis head of her walking stick.
"Have you seen James?" Cordelia demanded without preamble.
"No," said Anna shortly. "No clue as to his whereabouts, I'm afraid."
Cordelia frowned, not because of James, but because of Anna's expression. "Anna, what's wrong?"
Anna scowled.
"I had come here to horsewhip Charles, but it appears that he is elsewhere."
"Charles Fairchild?"
Cordelia echoed blankly.
"I believe he's at home. He called a gathering at his house for high-ranking enclave members. You could go horsewhip him there, but it would make for a very strange meeting."
High-ranking enclave members? Anna rolled her eyes. Well, no wonder I don't know about it. So I suppose I'll have to wait until later to puncture him like the pustulant boil he is. Anna began to pace within the small confines of the stairwell. Charles, she said. Bloody Charles, everything in service of his ambitions. She whirled, slamming her walking stick against a stair. He has done a dreadful, dreadful thing. I need to go to the infirmary. She shouldn't be alone. I must see her.
See who?
Cordelia was bewildered.
Ariadne, said Anna.
Cordelia, would you accompany me to the sick room? Cordelia looked at Anna in surprise. Elegant, composed Anna. Though at the moment her hair was mussed, her cheeks flushed. She looked younger than she usually did.
Of course, Cordelia said.
Fortunately, Anna knew the way to the infirmary. They did not speak as they climbed the stairs, both lost in thought. The infirmary itself was much quieter than it had been the last time Cordelia was there. She did not recognize most of those who lay still and feverish in the beds. At the back of the room, a large screen had been pulled out to shield the patient there, Tatiana Blackthorne, presumably. Cordelia could see the silhouettes of Brother Enoch and Jem cast against the screen as they moved around Tatiana's bed. Anna's attention was focused on a single patient. Ariadne Bridgestock lay quietly against the white pillows. Her eyes were shut, and her rich brown skin was ashen, stretched tightly over the branching black veins beneath her skin. Beside her bed was a small table on which lay a roll of bandages and several stoppered jars of different coloured potions. Anna slipped in between the screens surrounding Ariadne's cot, and Cordelia followed, feeling slightly awkward. Was she intruding? But Anna looked up, as if to assure herself that Cordelia was there, before she knelt down at the side of Ariadne's bed, laying her walking stick on the floor. Anna's bowed shoulders looked strangely vulnerable. One of her hands dangled at her side. She reached out the other, fingers moving slowly across the white linen sheets until she was almost touching Ariadne's hand. She did not take it. At the last moment, Anna's fingers curled and dropped to rest, beside Ariadne but not quite touching. In a low and steady voice, Anna said, Ariadne, when you wake up, and you will wake up, I want you to remember this. It was never a sign of your worth that Charles Fairchild wanted to marry you. It is a measure of his lack of worth that he chose to break it off in such a manner.
He broke it off,
Cordelia whispered. She was stunned. The breaking off of a promised engagement was a serious matter, undertaken usually only when one of the parties in question had committed some kind of serious crime or been caught in an affair. For Charles to break his promise to Ariadne while she lay unconscious was appalling. People would assume he had found out something dreadful about Ariadne. When she awoke, she might be ruined. Anna did not reply to Cordelia. She only raised her head and looked at Ariadne's face, a long look like a touch.
Please don't die, she said in a low voice and rose to her feet.
Catching up her walking stick, she strode from the infirmary, leaving Cordelia staring after her in surprise. Lucy set her notebook aside. Matthew was drawing circles in the air with a forefinger and frowning lazily, as if he were a pasha looking over his court and finding them to be ill-mannered and unprepared for inspection. How are you, Luce? He said. He had moved to sit beside her on the settee. Tell the truth.
How are you, Matthew? Lucy retorted. Tell the truth.
I am not the one who saw the ghost of Gust, said Matthew and grinned. Sounds like an unfinished Dickens novel, doesn't it? The Ghost of Gust.
I am not the one who nearly tumbled off a rope I should easily have been able to climb, said Lucy quietly.
Matthew's eyes narrowed.
They were extraordinary eyes, so dark you could only tell they were green if you stood close to him. And Lucy had, many times. They were close now, close enough that she could see the slight scruff of golden hair along his jawline and the shadows under his eyes.
"That reminds me," he said, rolling up his sleeve. There was a long graze along his forearm. "I could use an Irazi."
He aimed a winning smile at her. All Matthew's smiles were winning.
"Here," he added and held out his steely to her. "Use mine."
She reached to take it from him, and, for a moment, his hand closed gently around hers.
"Lucy,"
he said softly, and she almost closed her eyes, remembering how he had put his coat around her in the street, the warmth of his touch, the faint scent of him, brandy and dry leaves. But mostly brandy. She looked down at their entwined hands, his more scarred than hers, the rings on his fingers. He began to turn her hand over in his, as if he meant to kiss her palm.
"You are a shadow hunter, Matthew," she said. "You should be able to scale a wall."
He sat back.
"And I am," he said. "My new boots were slippery."
"It wasn't your boots," said Lucy. "You were drunk. You're drunk now, too. Matthew, you're drunk most of the time."
He released her hand as if she had struck him. There was confusion in his eyes and visible hurt as well.
"I am not."
"Yes, you are. You think I can't recognize it?"
Matthew's mouth hardened into a narrow line.
"Drink makes me amusing."
"It does not amuse me to watch you hurt yourself," she said. "You are like a brother to me, Math." He flinched.
"Am I? No one else has such complaints about what I do, or my desire for fortification."
"Many are afraid to mention it," said Lucy. "Others, like my brother and my parents, do not see what they do not want to see. But I see, and I am worried."
His lip curled at the corner.
"Worried about me? I'm flattered."
"I am worried," said Lucy, "that you will get my brother killed."
Matthew did not move. He remained as still as if he had been turned to stone by the Gorgon in the old stories. The Gorgon was a demon, Lucy's father had told her, though in those days there were no shadow hunters. Instead, gods and demigods had walked on the earth, and miracles had showered down from the heavens like leaves from a tree in autumn. But there was no miracle here, only the fact that she might as well have stabbed Matthew in the heart.
"You are his parabatai," said Lucy, her voice shaking slightly. "He trusts you. To be at his back in battle, to be his shield and sword, and if you are not yourself..."
Matthew stood up, nearly upending the chair. His eyes were dark with fury.
"If it were anyone else but you, Lucy, saying these things to me..."
"Then what?"
Lucy also rose to her feet. She barely reached Matthew's shoulder, but she glared at him anyway. She had always given as good as she got in the soup ladle battles of their childhood.
"What would you do?"
He slammed his way out of her room without replying. In the end, James brought Grace to the drawing room. It was quiet in there and deserted. There was a fire on and he helped her into a chair close to it, bending to draw off her gloves. He wanted to kiss her bare hands, so vulnerable, so familiar from their days